Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk this morning from the a portion of the Kalama Sutra. Which is actually a portion of the Kesaputi Sutra, and sometimes it's known as Buddha's Charter of Free Inquiry. And it's a sutra that some of us have... It's not actually that well known, I don't think, but the teachings that come out of it are. So I wanted to talk about that this morning. And the part of it that I want to talk about is an interchange that the Buddha had with a group of people called the Kalamas. He was traveling around with his monks, the way he did, and he came to this small town of Kalama and was approached by the people there who were confused because they'd had a number of visits from wandering monks like Buddha teachers, and they discovered that these teachers not only had really different teachings, but they had kind of interesting ways of presenting them. And so they had heard of the Buddha by reputation, but they hadn't actually studied with him, so they didn't know his teachings at all. And so they asked him for his advice. They said... what they said to him was, "Venerable sir, some recluses and Brahmins visited this town and they expound, explain, and glorify their own doctrine. The doctrines of others they deprecate, revile, show contempt for, and disparage. As a result, we are in doubt about the teachings of all of them. Which spoke the truth and which falsehood?" So that was their question for Buddha. How do we know? How do we know which of these people are telling the truth and which aren't? And Buddha advised them, saying, "Kalama people, it is proper for you to doubt and to have perplexity under such circumstances." And then he gave them a number of ways to decide whether they should have faith in a teaching. And I've divided them, his advice, into three rough groups. So in the first group, what he said was, he said, "Do not believe in something just because it's been passed along and retold for many generations. So don't accept anything on hearsay or just because it's something you've been told." Then he said, "Do not believe in something just because it's become a traditional practice. Do not believe in something just because it is well known everywhere or it's a commonly held opinion." Another part of that was, "Do not believe what others say without any investigation." And then his final point in that group was, "Do not believe in something just because it is cited in a text or just because it accords with your scriptures." So that's the first group of advice that he gives them. He's telling them, don't believe in something just because it's part of a traditional teaching. And I think it's good advice, and I think the opposite of it could also be really good advice for us as Americans, kind of in this time, which would be, don't disbelieve something just because it's part of a traditional teaching. I think that we kind of go to the opposite extreme and say, you know, we want to pick and choose what we take out of the tradition, and we very quickly dismiss traditional beliefs and say, you know, well, that might have been true in that primitive culture, but we are so sophisticated that, you know, that we don't need to, you know, that we can kind of dismiss that. And the problem with doing that is that it's really easy to sort of overlook the underlying truth. in the tradition. So we sort of have the opposite problem, I think, generally. But the point that he's making to them, you know, is a good one. Just because you've heard it, just because it's in the scriptures, don't believe it's true merely on that account. I think, you know, that we also hear today a lot of people believing in something simply because it's written down in a holy book. I used to work with a guy who had pretty firm convictions, and he was telling me one day that that it was really easy for him to tell what was true and what wasn't, because if it was in, you know, the holy scriptures, he knew that it was true. And I asked him which holy scriptures he was referring to, you know, and he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, you know, I mean, are you talking about the Tao Te Ching? Are you talking about, you know, the Vedas? Are you talking about, you know, the Bible? Are you talking about the Quran?" And it hadn't occurred to him that there was maybe more than one holy scripture. So we had kind of an interesting discussion, during which it became clear to me that I felt just about as strongly about the Tao Te Ching as he did about his holy scriptures. So it was a little bit instructive for me. I didn't take it quite as literally, but I remember saying out loud at one point, "Everything you would need to know in order to live a good life is right here in the Tao Te Ching." So it always sort of makes me happy when I hear stuff like that come out of my mouth, because sometimes it hasn't actually processed through the brain, and that's how I realize that I've been thinking something, you know, once it comes out. And then I go, "Well, that was really dumb." So that's his first set of advice to them. And the next set was the part that gave me the most pause, and I think watch your blood pressure on a couple of these, because it'll be interesting, or watch your heart rate on a couple of these. The first one of the next set was, do not believe something solely on the grounds of mere logic. Do not believe in something merely because it accords with your philosophy. Do not believe in something because it appeals to common sense. Do not believe in something just because you like the idea or it agrees with your preconceived notions. When I read those, I didn't even quite know what to make of it, you know. But it did point out to me the logic one in particular, you know. I mean, I have two German grandmas. I am like so into logic and so into common sense, and the idea of not believing something. First of all, the whole idea of mere logic just kind of made me crazy. But it really pointed out to me how much I sort of worship at the altar of logic, and how much I really like the idea of common sense, which would be, you know, my idea of how things are. And actually these days I'm getting more to enjoy uncommon sense. But the idea of not believing in something merely because it accords with your philosophy, I think is a really hard one for us. And I think it points up the need to be really careful about forming a philosophy that's too tight, one that you use to exclude other ideas too readily. And also, to, you know, that we have this way of wanting to make sense out of our experience, you know. So we're very quick to conceptualize what we see, to form ideas about what we see and what we hear, and then check those ideas against our notion of how the world is. You know, we have this real need to decide how we feel about something and fit it neatly into our philosophy or our logic or our idea of what common sense is. And by doing that, we kind of limit ourselves. The other thing is to remember that what makes common sense or what's logical to us may not be so logical to somebody else, or even to ourselves at a different moment in time. One of the things that I really like to do is read the letters to the editor in the paper, and I really particularly enjoy when I read a letter to the editor that's of an opinion that's totally different from mine, but relies totally on logic, because I like to pick it apart and go, you know, what's wrong? Can't they see the flaws in this logic, blah, 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 blah. But I also really like it when I see one that that I agree with totally and is based, like, totally on flawed logic. I kind of enjoy that. It's why I like watching The Daily Show. They do that a lot. Yeah, they're so right. And wait a minute. Wait a minute. And when we do that, you know, when we rely too much on our point of view or our philosophy or our idea of what logic or common sense is, you know, really it's a form of clinging. And it's also a form of grandiosity, I guess. But we're clinging to our idea of what's right, you know, our point of view. We are trying to fit everything neatly into a little box that says this is the way I believe. And the flip side of this whole piece of advice is that you shouldn't reject something because it fits into a view of the world that you've rejected. So there's that side of it too. So that's his second, the second group of advice that he gives them is not to believe something just because it fits into your worldview. And the last group is do not believe something merely because the speaker seems trustworthy or because it's what something a seemingly believable person says. And the other one is, do not believe something thinking this is what our teacher says. Do not accept anything thinking that the teacher is respected by us and that therefore it's right to accept his or her words. So this is kind of an awkward one to talk about. But last week, if you were here last week, you'll remember that the Rinpoche talked about this a little bit when he said that it's really important to investigate a teacher, not to jump too quickly into becoming anyone's student, but you really need to look carefully before you commit to a particular teacher or a particular teaching, and that. Teachings and the teachings need to reside on their own merit, you know, not on unverifiable propositions. That you need to not jump too quickly, and I think this is something that, as Americans, we do in particular with Eastern philosophies. I think it's, you know, that we get very enamored and we jump in a little too quickly. So I think it's really important not to do that, but to watch the teacher very carefully and, you know, see if they're really walking the walk. And these teachers in particular, the ones that the Kalamas were asking him about, the ones that explain and glorify their own doctrines, the doctrines of others, they deprecate, revile, show contempt for, and disparage. I think that that right there is a reason to be really wary about somebody. That, I mean, what are they doing here? It's it's the precept about elevating the self while denigrating others. And I think it's a real tip-off. So right there, I think they needed to be careful. That's what the Buddha had to tell them about what to be careful about. And along with those cautions, he also had some practical advice for them on what's wholesome. And this is what he said about that. When you directly know such and such things are unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by the wise, and if practiced lead to harm and suffering, you need to abandon them. On the other hand, when you directly know these and these things are wholesome, blameless, praised by the wise, and lead to well-being and happiness when adopted and carried out, then you should enter and remain in them. I don't even know what to say about that. I don't want to say, well, that's common sense, because I just told you not to listen to common sense. But he gave them examples of, you know, if a person is greedy or thinking about killing somebody, would that be, you know, skillful, blameworthy, criticized by... So he kind of walked them through a few examples of things that were unskillful, blameworthy, criticized by the wise. And so we had this real sort of everyday kind of just think it through kind of advice for them. And the caveat there is that, you know, hopefully they can tell the difference. In order to take this kind of advice, you do have to have some kind of an ethical framework, or you have to have sort of a beginning place. And that is where I think the three gems of Buddhism, the Triple Treasure, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, are a big help. The idea of, you know, if you want to be sure about, you know, what is blameless or what is good or wholesome, it really helps to have the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. In other words, the Buddha meaning the teacher, it helps to have a teacher. It helps to have the teachings there, and it helps to have a Sangha, because when you aren't sure and when you're leaning in one direction or you're kind of going off this way, the Sangha and the teachings and the teacher are what are going to prop you back up. I want to talk a little bit about the setting and the context for this. First of all, the Buddha was when he said all this, he was answering a direct question from people who didn't know him. They knew of him, but they didn't know anything about his teachings. You know, they hadn't studied with him. They hadn't heard a talk from him. At this point, he was just another one of these teachers who was wandering through. And when he told them, you know, these things, he didn't say anything about his own teachings. He didn't ask them to accept him. He didn't ask them, he didn't start expounding his own teachings. It doesn't say this, but I'm just going to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he didn't start deprecating the other teachers. But he doesn't expound his own dharma. He doesn't put himself forward. And this is one of the traditions of Buddhism that I really like, which is that we don't particularly have a tradition of evangelism. You know, if you want to know about the Buddha Dharma, about the Buddha's teachings, you really kind of have to ask. You have to look into it. We don't go around knocking on doors, as I'm sure our neighbors are happy to notice. And we as Minnesotans are also probably happy about. I wouldn't want to do that. So the Buddha answers their questions, but he doesn't immediately say, and here, let me tell you my truth. Let me give you my teachings. He also doesn't exclude himself from these admonitions about the teachers. One of the early things that I liked about Buddhism was this idea that Buddha said, you know, don't take any of the stuff on faith. Don't take any of the stuff because of my reputation. Don't take any of this as necessarily true just because you've heard it from me. You know, think about it. Experience it in your own life. Test it. You know, work this out for yourselves and see if it's true or not. And then you can follow these teachings, you know, or you can abandon them. And the thing that I liked about that was that it implied a lot of self-confidence. You know, it said to me that, you know, here's somebody who, you know, has a lot of confidence in what he's saying, and also somebody who has a lot of confidence in the people that he's talking to. You know, he had the confidence, well, actually I didn't think about everybody, I thought about me. He has confidence in me, you know, that I can take this, that I can listen to it, that I can put it into practice in my life and tell for myself whether this is something that I want to be doing or not. So, you know, the idea of faith in Buddhism is something that it's something that we don't talk a lot about because it's not an end in itself. You know, having faith in the teaching is kind of like you know, reading a book about Buddhism and saying, "Well, that's it. I'm a Buddhist now." Well, actually, you know, just having faith or having belief in it or having some understanding of the Buddha's teachings isn't what makes you a, you know, a sort of card-carrying Buddhist, if there is such a thing. And when I say Buddhism, a Buddhist, what I mean actually is somebody who follows the Buddha's teachings and tries to put them into action in their lives. Because I don't think there really is such a thing as a Buddhist. It reminds me, should I tell this? I just had one of those moments where I sort of caught it just before it came out of my mouth. I'm going to go ahead. It reminds me of one of my favorite lines from All in the Family. Some of you are too young to remember what All in the Family is, probably, unless they have it on Nick at Night or something. But it was this show. And Archie Bunker, the lead character in the show, was this notorious bigot, and he had a son-in-law who had lived at one point on a commune. And Archie said one time, "Well, if you've lived on a commune, that makes you a communist." It was my favorite line from that show. But his point was, you know, he's taking something that somebody has done and then using that to kind of put them in this box. And I think that reading a book about Buddha's teachings or saying everything that Buddha said made perfect sense to me doesn't make you a Buddhist. It makes you somebody who has read something or heard something or agreed with something, and it isn't until you put it in action in your life and you try it out and you actually live your life according to these teachings that you are a Buddhist, even if there were such a thing. So I don't really like the term Archie Bunker kind of ruined the term Buddhist for me. So I actually don't think of myself as a Buddhist. I think of someone who, to the best of her ability, follows tries to follow the Buddha's teachings in her life. So that's what happens when I things come into my brain and I don't check them before they go out my mouth. I say things like that on the mic. So where was I before I got off on Archie Bunker? Faith. So faith in the teaching, is important. It's kind of what gets us off the dime. But it's really just a starting point in a process of waking up, in a process of inner transformation that can occur if you follow the teachings, if you actually do something about them. Sharon Salzberg wrote a book, a wonderful book on faith in Buddhism, and she talked about two kinds of faith. She said that there's one kind of faith is called bright faith. It's the state of love-filled delight in the possibilities and eager joy at the prospect of actualizing them. So that's that sort of initial faith. When you first hear about a teaching or you first meet a teacher and you just think they're wonderful, and it's sort of that, it's almost like kind of an infatuation. So there's that bright faith. It's exciting. It's that young love. And then there's verifying faith. And she describes that as the process of examining in a critical and discriminating way the teacher or teaching that awakened bright faith. This is a crucial step of verifying or validating through our own experience what we previously have only heard of or seen outside ourselves. So this is the important part about faith. It's that step of verifying it in our own lives. And until we've done that, all it is sort of a belief or a hypothesis or actually a philosophy or maybe common sense or logic, but it's not anything that we're actually doing to change our lives or to change anybody else's lives. So, in Buddhism, faith isn't really the point, because Buddhism isn't really about beliefs, it's about our actions. It's a very action-oriented religion or philosophy. The Buddha said, if you want to live a happy life, if you want to live a good life, if you want to live a life in which you rid yourself of, suffering and that struggle and that kind of angst that we walk around with, here's what you need to do. And it's actually very, very simple. Another one of the things that I like about Buddhism is that it's extraordinarily simple. I go around sometimes to high schools and other groups and talk about Buddhism. I was at Crete and Durham Hall this week, and I'm always a little bit afraid when I go around and talk about Buddhism that somebody's going to raise their hand and say, is that all there is? It's just that? Because I'll talk about the Four Noble Truths and I'll talk about the Eightfold Path, and nobody's done it yet, but I'm sort of worried, that someday they're going to say, is that it? That's awfully simple. And I'll have to say, well, yeah, it really is. That really is it. On the other hand, so for those of us who like, just give me some simple advice on how to live my life, on how to rid myself and others of this suffering, of this struggle that we walk around with. Buddhism is very, very simple. On the other hand, for those of us who really like deep philosophy, it's also got that behind it. And so you can spend lifetimes, if you're interested in that, going through the sutras and reading Dogen and delving into the very deep philosophical underpinnings of it. And I love that too, but mostly I'm a simple girl, so I like the Four Noble Truths and I like the Eightfold Path. and the precepts. And sometimes I think, you know, I could get by with just that. With just that. Because in fact, the best Buddhist lessons that I've learned aren't so much the deeply philosophical ones. They're the practical ones. You know, I think I've learned probably the most important Buddhist lessons through things like waiting for the bus and work practice. You know, one of the ways that Buddhism has turned my life around the most is that I don't find work boring anymore. You know, like housework, like cleaning, like, well, dusting. I'll make an exception for dusting, maybe. But putting the teachings into action and paying attention to what's going on right now, you know, right here, what's under my nose, and not adding levels of complaining and suffering to what I'm doing has probably taught me more about Buddhism than anything else. Waiting for the bus. You know, one time, I've told this story before, but it's so simple. Years ago, I was waiting for the bus, and it was like one of those 20 below days. And it was so cold, and I was just freezing. And I was standing out, and I was actually standing on a big pile of snow because it was also, you know, it had been a really snowy winter. So I was standing on this huge pile of snow looking down the road, and there was no bus in sight. And it was 20 below, and the wind was whipping. And I was thinking, it is so cold. I just can't stand it. It's so cold. And I had this thought, it's a good thing I have a nice warm coat. And as soon as I had that thought, I realized that it wasn't really that I was cold, because I had this really warm coat on, I had boots on, I had on a hat, you know, and a muffler, and really, I wasn't cold. It was the idea of cold. You know, it was the idea of, it's January, this is going to go on for months yet. You know, blah, 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 blah. So it wasn't actually the immediate surroundings that were what was causing my suffering. It was all the stuff that I was adding on top of it. And it's kind of the same way with cleaning my house. You know, it isn't actually the act of vacuuming that's making me suffer here. It's all the stuff and all the chatter and all the, you know, all that stuff that's around it. So those are the places where, you know, those activities of life, of watching. Watching my karma unfold with great interest and with humor, that's given me the most insight into the Buddha's teachings. So, actually, I think I'm going to stop there. I kind of got off on a tangent there. The Buddha didn't tell the Kalamas what his teachings were. But I can't help myself. I have to go there sometimes. So anyway, that all came out of a conversation, by the way, that I had with somebody a few months ago. I was in a... I got to spend quite a bit of time in close contact with a number of ministers from different faiths. And one of them... I was having a discussion with one of them one time that started with talking about evangelism, and then we got talking about belief and faith, and he said, I can't remember if he said, I have faith because I believe, or if he said, I believe because I have faith. And it was one of those things that, you know, just kind of makes your mind stop, you know, and I went, wait a minute, it's totally circular logic. And it got me thinking about faith, and then it got me going back into the sutras to see, you know, where this whole thing came from. And I had actually forgotten about the Kalamas, and that's where that all came from. But so that's how we got onto the Kalama Sutra this morning. So is anybody have any other reasons not to believe in something?
Well, I have a simple question.
Oh, those are my favorite.
Yeah. If you can't rely on logic, if you don't believe what your teacher tells you, you can't believe in common sense.
Yeah. What do you do if you can't believe in logic or what your teacher says? What he's saying here is, you know, he's not saying to dismiss it out of hand, but he's saying don't believe in something solely because of that. Don't believe in something only because of that. Don't take what your teacher tells you and say, well, it came out of their mouth, and I believe in this teacher, and so it must be true. You know, don't make that leap. You really need to ground it in something else. You need to ground it in your life, your experience, test it out. So you shouldn't also make the opposite mistake of saying I'm going to reject everything out of hand. He's not telling you to do that. Yeah.
There are so many different beliefs around these days. There are spiritual ones. And, of course, the air is filled with economic and political ones.
Yeah.
At work, there's a fellow who's a fan of Ron Paul. And he's very bright, my friend is. And so is Ron Paul. But I listen to what my friend has to say, and I think, well, Ron Paul is kind of a half-baked Leninist. He understands Lenin's critique of imperialism, if he doesn't understand Lenin's critique of the state or Lenin's ideas about the party, etc. I can say this because I used to be a fully baked Leninist. But anyway, my friend, as I say, he's very bright and got engaged with other members of the staff at work in a political discussion. And one of his emails, which I don't know, must have in a dozen pages long, he listed about 3 dozen books, all of which were recommended and essential reading about the political economy of America today and why we all needed to read these things and get up to date. So, belief. These days, one of the advantages of living past a certain point is you can start thinking of oneself at an earlier stage as an earlier life. So I look back at myself in earlier lives, and I have a different perspective on beliefs these days. Beliefs, they give us a way of moving through the world. And if you grab onto Ron Paul's beliefs, they give you one way. And if you grab onto Lenin's, they give you another. So for me, the central question is, how do these beliefs make me act? What do I do? And that's how I judge how attractive a set of beliefs is. It's what it leads me to do and how I therefore relate to other people. The second thing is the question, I think the fundamental one for me is, who is it that needs these fond opinions? Why are we continually trying to construct this self, grabbing onto this set of ideas because they're mine and they're different from this other set of ideas? The self which gets us in so much trouble.
I'd add on to that, that discussion about, it's interesting, what you brought up about the editorial page and it being able to read an argument that is completely rational against yours, or and then your belief system, and also arguments that don't seem very rational that support your belief system. The whole idea of rationality to me is called into question, because I think whenever a rational thought comes into my brain, an emotion comes with it. Mm-hmm. That emotion is the connection to the strong sense of personal self. And as far as the Sangha goes, I think in every culture throughout history, Buddhist Sangha and other religious groups have spent their time sort of editing the metaphor of their religious beliefs. And I think that probably we do that differently here than they do it across the country or across the world or across time. And even in the context of what we do here and our belief system and the sense of, well, is it, you have to believe everything or not. I know that I listened to Guy's lectures before, and he's questioned that notion of the historical Buddha, and I thought, oh yeah, that's fine. I like that, because I don't really want to attach to the sense that Buddha existed in this period of time and did this and this and this. For me, the sense of Sangha is the people here creating, you know, reinterpreting the metaphor of the philosophy. And I also like the idea of, you know, I've lived long enough to see my belief systems change, and I'd like to think that I'm practicing to let go of strong beliefs. I mean, I'm always going to not walk across the street when a car's coming, but there's a lot of things that I can let go of because the rational thought isn't always, it isn't absolutely correct. It's always tainted by a sense of self-reflection on what the rationale is for anything I do. So it's interesting to see how life forces you to let go of a lot of the things you used to know and just work with people on creating a metaphor.
Yeah, and I think that a light touch really helps with all of that, you know. I sort of love it when I run into a way that, when I notice something that I have really held as a cherished belief, and then I sort of, somebody pokes a hole in it, I actually kind of enjoy that. I think it's fun. I don't enjoy it, on the other hand, when I notice the way that I've coalesced something into this really serious sense of self and who I am, and you know, it's really easy to do. And it's so, you know, I feel it right here in the middle of my chest when I notice that I'm clinging on to something, and usually it has to do with some way that I've defined this very solid self. I don't remember even what it was, but a few months ago, I felt that, and it was such a difficult feeling that I just stayed with it and watched it with great interest. This idea of it was actually a physical feeling of oh, there's this self, and it's this idea of who I am, and it's under attack, and it's really an uncomfortable feeling. And usually it's your notion of who you are being attacked. And when that happens, if instead of fighting against it, you can just watch it with really soft attention. Oh, you know, oh, you poor thing. You know, oh, you poor thing. This is what it's like. And I remember thinking, we had just had a discussion here about the self and the notion that, you know, well, actually there is no sort of unchanging self there. And I remember thinking, this feels like a pretty solid self to me, you know, and it was a very painful kind of a thing. But if you can just kind of stay with it and stay with that notion of, you know, this idea has been just, oh, you poor dear. And usually those feelings are attached to our notions of logic, common sense, how the world ought to be. Anything else? I'd way rather hear somebody else talk than me.